Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight, especially on such a dreary day. My name is Alexander Provan, and I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy. This is one of the events that is part of our contribution to Expo One, and it's called Speculations, the Future is Blank, or imagine an underscore, a series of underscores. So it's 50 days of speculations on the future in the form of conversations, lectures, discussions, and performances and panels. Many of those take place across the hall in what is being called the classroom, which is an installation that we did with the artist Jose Leon Cirillo. And the other half are taking place in this room, which is an installation by the artist Adrian Villarrojas. And there are calendars with a list of all of the programs which last until the end of July, directly outside of the entry to the classroom in the hallway. So please pick one up and come and join us in the future. And so I'm just going to introduce David real quickly, but basically David will talk for, I think, 20 or 30 minutes, and then we'll have 15 or 20 minutes for a discussion. So I've been following David Reif's writing for quite a long time, actually. And I think I first read his work in college, and it at once inspired me and made me sort of fearful of becoming involved with international development work, which I did for a short time. So he is, to my mind, one of the most consistently original and challenging and also unsparing writers. In his many books and innumerable works of journalism and criticism, he has impelled us to scrutinize the political and ethical foundations of our actions as individuals, as states, and as members of the so-called international community. And to his credit, he has never offered, he's never offered easy answers. Reif has spent much of his career thinking about the international order that emerged in the wake of World War II, specifically the gulf between its putative responsibilities to all citizens of the world, especially those ensnared by disasters made by man or nature, and the efficacy of the actions taken by groups such as the UN and NATO when they have taken action at all. Reif has in the past focused on the conflicts in Bosnia, where he lived as a reporter for some years, and also Afghanistan, Iraq, Rwanda, and elsewhere, and has written eloquently, if often punishingly, of the noble ideals and tragic failures of humanitarianism. Recently, he's turned his attention to the global food crisis and the institutions from the Gates Foundation to farmers' rights activists to the WTO that have proffered some remedies. And today, David will discuss the dire problem of food production and distribution and the political implications. So thank you all for coming, and thanks especially to David for being with us today.
Is this working for the streaming? As I've been told that this is the main thing about this microphone. Otherwise, I think even at my advanced age, I could probably do it without a mic. I'm here under slightly false pretenses because, unlike the premise of this thing, I haven't a clue what's going to happen in the future. Not the slightest idea. You know, Cicero, quoting Cato the Elder, says somewhere that he doesn't understand why when two soothsayers encounter each other in the road that they don't both burst out laughing. And I tend to that view, Roman view. Not the only Roman view I tend to. Anyway, that's another talk. So I'm an analyst. I'm not a predictor to the extent I'm interested in doing it. I'm not even all that interested in my opinions. I'm mostly interested in trying to figure out sort of why things are as they are. That is to say, why people think X or Y. My solutions, I suspect, are no better and probably quite a bit worse than many people's. So what I'm going to do, I'll try to talk for 20 minutes and hope to have provoked you sufficiently to want to ask pointed questions of one kind or another, or talk about something else. But what I'm going to try to do is describe sort of where we came in this food, in this question of the global food system. And the most of you will remember with this huge spike in the prices of essential food staples in 2007-08, when after what was basically a very long period of secular decline in food prices started to rise. And they, of course, were, that was particularly damaging to the poorer you got, the more damaging it became, for the simple and unpleasant reason that the poorer you are, the more, the larger the percentage, not just the absolute number, but the larger the percentage of your income and your resources you spend on food. So that, for example, an American spends, the average American family spends something like 11, well, it's a little higher because of the recent rises, somewhere between 11 and 13% of its budget on food. The average family, say, in Chad or Niger or Timor-Leste or such places, very poor place, Haiti, spend somewhere between 45 and 55% of their income on food. So, I mean, when the price spike happened in 2007, people actually went hungry. You added something like 100 million people to those who are actually hungry in the world. So I'm going to sort of try to describe a little bit what the situation is and then the two possible responses to it, one of which is essentially technical, and that's the mainstream view. It's embodied by the major international food organizations, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, by the World Food Program, by the Bretton Woods institutions, which are the central players in all, well, everything having to do with poverty and with the developing world, that is to say the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And of course the Gates Foundation, which is now a kind of state of its own. And in many cases, the Gates Foundation gives up to 20 or 25% of the budget for major international health and nutrition initiatives. The polio campaign for many years now is 20% Bill Gates's money. When you think that they're major national donors doing this, it gives you some idea. I mean, even to give you a, by analogy, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Geneva Committee as it's sometimes called, the United States contributes 25% of the Red Cross's, of the ICRC's budget. So in other words, only 5% more than Gates does to a number of very important international programs. And then a lot of private and NGO initiatives about hunger, particularly something called AGRA, which is an acronym for the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, is largely, although founded by the Rockefeller Foundation, or initially paid for by the Rockefeller Foundation, is now largely supported by the Gates Foundation. So that's one side. And on the other side, I'll try to sort of describe what I think. I mean, you'll be able to infer more or less where I stand in this, I expect. But sort of what their presuppositions are. And then opposing them are a kind of mix of movements and figures. The most important probably would be what's called the right to food movement, which essentially views food as a right. It takes a kind of human rightsist approach to the thing and to the problem and in terms of the solution it offers. It considers that, you know, like any right, government should be accountable. Now, obviously, there are problems with positive liberties, because with a negative liberty, say the torture is the injunction against torture to be free from torture is a negative liberty. Nothing has to be done except for the torturers to stop torturing. There are no resources involved. But if you say food is a right, what does that mean in a very poor country? Because food may be a right, but there's no food, yeah? And so either the economic system has to be turned on its head, or more likely, the international system in which these poor countries are imbricated. And these poor countries play a specific role in the international system. That, that's what we would call a positive right. And it's not clear that it can be enforced. But the view of the right to food movement, this includes groups like Via Campesina, which is a loose alliance of peasant organizations, of various green movement actors, the so-called agroecology movement. A figure like Marion Nestle in this country would be one representative of that view. And then a lot of people who are whose analysis of global food system is part of their general analysis, what you might call the anti-globalization movement. So on a certain level, this debate, writ small, if you like, is the debate between Davos and Porto Alegre, often quite literally, in the sense that most of the people involved in mainstream food activities are at Davos. Indeed, many of the initiatives, the most recent being a big business initiative at the time of the creation of something called the Scaling Up Nutrition Movement, was actually done at Davos. And then, in the various forms of the anti-globalization movement, which is a bit harder to define, and it's a bit more elusive because there are probably wider differences within it than within the mainstream view. You really do have the center of it being either Porto Alegre or the anti-globalization demonstrations that virtually always occur at the time of the GATT talks or at the time of meetings of the WTO, the World Trade Organization. You saw it. And they're either demonstrating or they're having, as they did in the Doha round recently, sort of alternate meeting on the edge of it. So these are the two views. What's the problem? Again, I think it's, Keynes said in the long run we're all dead, but actually there's a Marxist economist called Joan Robinson who said in the long run we're back in the short run. And I've always thought that was closer to the reality myself. But what's the problem? There, if you go back to the people who started to think about food in the end of the 18th century, above all the clergyman Robert Thomas Malthus, the view was that food production could not possibly support a rising population. Basically, the principle was food population increases, multiplies, and food production only adds. And that eventually the ability to produce food would be inferior to the population, and starvation would then ensue, which would bring things back into balance. Malthus thought these great kind of culls, we would say if we were talking about other than human beings, would sort of restore the thing. And this was a view that was very widely believed for a good part of the 19th century. It was really only with the so-called famine codes of the British Raj in the 1870s and 1880s that people started to move away from this kind of Malthusian paradigm. And in many parts of the world, people still think it. It's a kind of, because it makes intuitive sense. You'd think, there's no limit on how many people can be born. There is a limit on how much land there is in the world, for example. So it makes kind of intuitive sense that Malthus would have been right. But so far, at least, Malthus was dead wrong. He was wrong in the sense of imagining that food production couldn't be upped radically. And he was wrong, interestingly enough, and this has been thought through a lot, first by the the great economist Amartya Sen, and later by an Irish famine specialist called Cormac O'Grada, who have shown pretty clearly that actually famine is a lousy way to control population. And that, and if you look at, Ireland is the worst famine, it's thought, in the history of the world in terms of the proportion of population who died. Something like a quarter of the Irish population died in the famine in 1846, 47, 48. I mean, there are obviously many more Irish people today than there were at the time of the famine. So, I mean, that's a kind of crude demonstration of it, but we have 100 examples in the historic homelands of famine, which are Asia, India and China. There are other examples of this. So Malthus was wrong, but Malthus, as they say, only has to be right once. It isn't, you know, the fact that he's been wrong, there's no law of physics or you know, mechanics that says Malthus is always going to be wrong. It's just he's been proven wrong. And again, since, as I started by saying, I'm not much for the future, I'm going to sort of leave that at that. Will he be right? Maybe. But here's the problem, that we're now 7 billion. We'll be 9 billion probably in the 2040s. The flatline demographic projections are not a very accurate, historically have not been very accurate. But a relatively good scenario would be for the world's population to level off at somewhere on the order of 10 billion. And it could be more, it could be a little less. It depends how quickly many countries are making a demographic transition. I'm talking about countries in the global south. Poor countries are making a demographic transition to much, much smaller families. Mexico's already down near below replacement level. It's closer to the United States or to Britain than it is to, say, Pakistan, despite the way people talk about Mexico in this country. So you're talking about in the next, literally, it's, what are we, 2013, let's say it's, take the conservative, add the nicer estimate that you're going to have 9 billion people by 2050. That's only 37 years from now. And that's talking about 2/5 or so increase in global population. You're going to have to radically bump up food production in order to feed them. So that's the challenge. And to add to the challenge, you have, even though I know that in Washington this is not yet considered to be a fact, but you have global climate change, global warming, as we used to call it back when we were actually telling the truth about it rather than placating Senator Imhoff. And that will affect disproportionately the countries with the quickest growing populations. It's kind of Sod's Law, as the Brits say, and the places that are the poorest places. So sub-Saharan Africa, particularly the northern belt just south of the Sahara, is probably going to be the worst affected, and bits of Central and Southwest Asia look like they're going to be affected, which means that it'll be harder to grow crops. So you've got 2 billion more people, probably a billion of whom will be in Africa, in a situation where you've got to grow a great deal more. So that's the problem. What's the solution? Well, the Gates people, the mainstream view is we're going to have this wonderful, we're going to make these fantastic technological discoveries, plant science and the rest. And if you read the literature, I wrote a piece not so long ago in Foreign Policy magazine in Washington, which I seem to be writing for these days, comparing the kind of techno-utopianism of Silicon Valley to the techno-utopianism, if you will, of Jeff Sachs at the Earth Institute at Columbia here in New York, or Gates, the Gates Foundation in Seattle, and indeed some of the people who run the food institutions. The World Food Program particularly has this view. I think the World Bank, under its current president, has this view. A view that basically we have the technical knowledge to fix these problems. And that would be a combination of plants that are resistant to rain and drought. It would involve information for farmers. I mean, it's not surprising that the chairman, the former, you know, the guy who owns Microsoft would, you know, think that information technology is a way out. So the idea is farmers would be able on mobile phones and other methodologies to know what prices are, and therefore pricing systems would be more advantageous to them. There are some political reforms. I don't want to stereotype it beyond, they talk about good governance, they talk about transparency, they're very keen on an end to corruption. The mainstream view includes all of those opinions, but it's paired with a confidence that, as it were, there are no contradictions. Everyone really knows the right thing to do. It's just a question of getting the political will and committing the money to do it. So Jeffrey Sachs, in his book, The End of Poverty, which he wrote and published in 2005, said that ending extreme poverty in the world would cost $30 billion. Which, of course, if you don't believe in political conflict in any serious way, that might make sense to you. But I suppose I don't doubt that there are technological fixes, although you have to be careful. It shouldn't escape your notice that, you know, one of the major Gates initiatives is called the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, the Green Revolution having famously not affected Africa. It was something that began in Mexico and the Philippines, and of course had its greatest success in India, and to a somewhat modified degree, modified by the communist government in China. A different process, but some of the same. I mean, communist modernization theory and capitalist modernization theory aren't that far apart. That's one of the things when you start reading, you sort of read someone like Rostow, who's the great American modernization theorist in the 1950s at the time of the Green Revolution. It just feels like, as someone once said, some nasty French Marxist, it's just, you know, Marxist, it's just the Marxism is missing. You know, otherwise it's exactly the same. And hunger, as there's a scholar, I think he teaches at Indiana, called Nick Colliter, who wrote a very good book, excellent book, about the Cold War and the Green Revolution. And it's very clear that the Green Revolution was, to some extent, not by the scientists, I don't mean that, but that the way it was taken up was as a weapon, as part of the struggle between the United States and the communist world. John Foster Dulles, the Eisenhower Secretary of State, famously said, where hunger is, communism follows, et cetera. There are technological fixes, but the Green Revolution has had all kinds of unanticipated consequences environmentally in India, and it's by no means entirely clear, because of questions of water, whether it can be sustained at the level that people thought it was. It's incredibly wasteful of water, and it consumes a tremendous amount of fuel and chemicals. And those inputs have very grave long-term environmental effects already in Punjab use. And I'm not even talking about the social effects, you know, the unemployment, that the mechanization that was the other part of the Green Revolution, the massive unemployment in the places where it was actually most successful. But it is true that there is all kinds of work being done, not only in GM. I'm going to not talk very much about GM. I don't actually think it's essential. I think this technological view could exist with kind of what you'd call standard hybridization rather than genetic modification. The Gates people do a lot of hybrid stuff, and they don't necessarily, they're very much for GM, and Gates is a major investor in various ag companies, and the former head of some part of Monsanto, a guy called Robert Horsch, now works at the Gates Foundation, a very senior level. So, you know, as Deep Throat said, follow the money. But there's progress in hydroponics. There's projects in different kind of tillage that uses less water. There are alternatives to the kind of largely nitrogen-based and petroleum-based fertilizers that are now in common usage in the global south. But the question to ask yourself is, you know, does this narrative make sense? The objection is obvious. The objection is the same objection that people made to Francis Fukuyama when he posited the end of history. Because the mainstream view is basically, there is no ideological problem. We all agree on the system we should have. That's called liberal capitalism. And we all agree on what governance should more or less be like. It's sort of, it's as my friend John Gray likes to say, a sort of more humane version of the United States is the sort of general view in this kind of global elite. More like sort of Canada, I think. There's an old joke about Moses had a stutter, you know, and so the old joke goes that when he said, when they thought he was saying Canaan, he was in fact saying Canada. And so the Fukuyama view is we've solved the ideological problem, therefore it's a technical question. It's technical questions of governance, and it's a technical question of technique. If you believe that, well, I could say if you believe that, you'll believe anything, but let's say if you believe that, then the views of the Gates Foundation and of Jeff Sachs and the Earth Institute and of the FAO and the rest make sense. Because I want to stop in about 5 minutes, there are plenty of nuances within the mainstream view and plenty of versions of it. But it is an end of history view. Because it's assumed like anti-agonistic. It assumes that NGOs, governments, and above all business, all, as they always say, have their role to play. And if they all sort of put their shoulder to the collective wheel, we can reduce poverty very dramatically. And, you know, there's some evidence, incidentally, for that, you know, in the there have been a tremendous number of people lifted out of poverty in India and China in their capitalist versions. Probably more people than have been lifted out of poverty in all of history. Coastal China and, you know, sort of metropolitan, particularly southern India, in Chennai and such places. The opposition view, predictably, is that to the contrary, this is basically a political crisis. To solve the problem of hunger, you A, have to rethink agriculture in a more ecologically sound way, and that it's a mystification to say that you need these technologies. And so there's an argument about technology. There's not an argument about, just to come back to the first point, there's no argument that we have to massively increase food production if a lot more people aren't going to go hungry, and perhaps even if that famine will return. I'm a very pessimistic fellow, and I tend to see the glasses three quarters empty, not just half. But it must be said that one of the great accomplishments in world history is the virtual abolition of famine for natural causes, which took place basically in the second half of the 20th century. There hasn't been a famine in India. There was a famine in India roughly every 30 years for all of recorded history, as far as we know. As far back as we go, we can find records of famine, more or less. Famines occur sort of with the same rhythm as war, sort of 30, 40 years like that. There hasn't been a famine in India since the Great Bengal Famine of 1943. They've come close a couple of times. China used to have famines. There was this terrible man-made famine made by the Maoists, by the Red, you know, the sort of the Mao's decision to unleash the Red Guards, Cultural Revolution in 1959. But the famine that were the product of weather, climate, a natural disaster, we haven't wanted one of the real one of those in some time. Even the famines in the Horn of Africa are as much, if not more, political nowadays than they are natural. It's true that they, people, you know, that questions of coping mechanisms, of the ability to cope, if you have 10 years of drought, as you had in some parts of Somalia and Ethiopia and Djibouti, you're going to have, more people are going to die. But the famine was, to a very large extent, the product of politics. So, which was not true in the past. I mean, there was a potato blight in Ireland. In fact, they just identified the actual cause of the blight just the other day. Fascinating bit of scientific detective work. But if you know, what we've been quite unsuccessful, although there are exceptions like Brazil and Mexico and Vietnam, in dealing with chronic malnutrition. And of course, if we don't produce a lot more food, not only will there not be any fewer hungry people or malnourished or undernourished people, there's a distinction, but there'll be many more of them. Indeed, there were 100 million more as a result of the 2007-2008 crisis, which, although it abated, is now, food prices were back up again in 2011-2012. It's said they'll come up again in 2015. So lots of reasons for that we've talked about. So the people who take the other side of this view basically say, you're not going to solve the food crisis without a fairer world. And you're not going to get a fairer world by the alliance of the Gates Foundation, Monsanto, the US government, and whatever. So I think I'll just stop there, because I think I've gone on long enough. And, you know, there are lots of gaps in this. And I've spent the last 5 years of my one and only life writing this book, which I still haven't finished. It may be the latest book in the history of the world. So one has all too much to say.
Okay, so I might start by asking a few questions. First, I'm not sure everyone here has a great sense of what the Green Revolution was and what its effects were. Maybe you could briefly expand on that and specifically talk about how it may have been used to suppress demands for land reform and other kind of rights-based advocacy that is now returning in the form of groups like Lovia Campesina.
Well, the Green Revolution was there were these biologists, mostly from the universities of Minnesota and Iowa, who, and the most famous of whom is Norman Borlaug, after whom the World Food Prize is named, who did develop new strains, germplasm that resulted in much, much higher yields, particularly of wheat, and latterly of corn, well, both really, in Mexico, one. And these methodologies, these kinds of this kind of farming, which is also about mechanization, about very heavy use of fertilizers, about quite larger uses of water in places where water is traditionally not used as much, like southern Mexico, in maize in southern Mexico. This really worked. And the food production in Punjab, I think, doubled in the period of the institutionalization of these models. Philippines as well. The Chinese, as I say, using a somewhat different model, but with some of the same ideas behind it. In the 60s, radically, once the Cultural Revolution was more or less over in 64, 65, they pretty much started a similar set of procedures, and they now have very highly, the use of water in Chinese farming is extremely high. So, the environmental downside is what it is. I'm a little skeptical of any kind of correlation between. I wish it were true, but I don't think it is true that this was a way of stymieing land reform. It was a way of making the governments the Americans supported more attractive to populations. But there's an Australian economist called D.A. Lowe, who wrote a small book many years ago called The Egalitarian Moment, which basically talks about the end of colonialism and the failure to do land reform. And Lowe's view, at least, is that there was this chance, and he uses Egypt and Indonesia and some other places. And his view is generally that it was local elites who blocked land reform. So I don't think you can make a correlation, particularly since, for example, in Indonesia, the communist movement in Indonesia was largely urban. And there was no food shortage in Indonesia anyway. That wasn't the issue. So I don't think you can really sustain that.
And maybe you could also say how much of that increased production was of cash crops for export and what the relationship is between that and the pressure to compete on an international economy which contains a lot of food produced by countries that subsidize agriculture, maybe using Haiti as an example.
Using where? Haiti.
Haiti.
Yeah. Well, there's no direct link between the Green Revolution and these events. I mean, what's true is that the World Bank, at a certain point, imposed on the developing world, the Global South, what was called the Structural Adjustment Program. And what structural adjustment where agriculture is concerned was that you would basically take the focus away from small farmers. Indeed, you would lift price controls. So you would, quote unquote, liberalize the market. You wouldn't guarantee the price they got, which would, first of all, knock out a lot of smallholder farmers. And second, make the most economical way of farming, big farming for export. And this was thought, since the idea was, basically, if you increased exports, you increased a country's prosperity. It was an extremely mechanistic view of the world. And I think the damage to agriculture has to do much more with that than to the Green Revolution. The other thing is the development people sort of wrote off agriculture about 40 years ago. And you see, if you look at aid to agriculture in the 50s and 60s, it's quite high. It then goes down in the 70s and really craters in the 80s. And it's not till really the last decade that people realize this had been a very bad mistake. And that anyway, in any case, exports don't. One of the things we have learned about development is that it's not true that turning a country from a poor country in terms of its gross domestic product to a middle-class country, it's called middle-income country, necessarily reduces poverty. Some of the worst poverty in the world is in middle-income countries. Ground zero for chronic malnutrition and undernutrition, not for famine, which is Africa, but for undernutrition and malnutrition, which maims but doesn't kill, is India. 46% of all children in India, next time you read about the Indian miracle, whether written by an Indian or by a foreign business person, you might think of this statistic. 46%, somewhere between 43 and 46% of Indian children are malnourished or undernourished.
Also, hasn't India continuously downgraded its definition of malnourishment?
Well, that's changing with this new law. That's a big debate in India. I think that now we're getting, much as I like burrowing about in the weeds, I think, I'm not sure how many other people besides.
Okay, I have one more question. You mentioned this, but it seems like a good link between your previous work. You've written a lot about the how unlikely it is that funds for humanitarian aid will be rationally appropriated. I'm wondering what you'd have to say about the rational distribution of food aid and whether that makes sense as something to think about or hope for, or what mechanisms might make that happen, or if it's a totally different
volume. Well, I'm not a great believer in human beings' capacity to reason and large numbers collectively. So if that's what we're depending on, we're fucked. That's not happening.
Coercion?
There's woman at Bowdoin who's written this book. It's all about how we should have, Mike Bloomberg's a little softy for his soda ban. You should basically ban everything, cigarettes and liquor, anything that has bad medical outcomes. You just sort of replace Christianity with health, and you sort of get the view of what she's up to. Sarah Crowley, she's her new book is about. I'm not kidding. About whether people should be allowed to have as many children as they like. It's pretty clear, where she's, anyway, blah, blah, blah. It's Margaret Sanger plus a few even more unpleasant people. People are not going to behave rationally. I mean, they never have. I think it'd be quite utopian to imagine that, suddenly because... Saul Bellow says somewhere that we're always, we think better of our own times because, at least in terms of our hopes, because they're the times in which we were fated to be born and are fated to die. But if you want to be rational, to use that word, which I'm not sure I understand, we could say that's too much Kierkegaard at an early age, but never mind. If you want to be rational, the rational conclusion is we've never done things very intelligently in the past, and we're highly unlikely to do things very intelligently in the future. The question is it's not a question of rationality. The question is there have been movements for justice that have improved things, and so I don't think people are going to come to their senses to use the Catholic term right reason. But movements for social change have failed and they've succeeded. And the food crisis is actually one context in which I think there is some chance of success, at least in some parts of the world. The best example of this is Brazil. There's one great success story in the world in fighting chronic and malnutrition and undernutrition on a systematic basis. And that's Brazil, the governments of Lula and Dilma. And these governments made nutrition a priority. And there actually are something and these are figures that even people way to the left of the Brazilian government, that is to say people who don't like either Lula or Dilma, will absolutely insist on when you go to talk to them, which is that, the 75% drop in malnutrition in Brazil. That's because the government says they're committed to it. In the end, that's what, my own view, but, I'm a kind of unreconstructed kind of social democrat, my view is if the state participates, it has a chance of working. That you may have to remake the state and put other people in to do it. But without the state, this idea that somehow the private sector and the NGOs and the this and the that can do it, I just think that's preposterous. Sir?
Are you...
Yeah, provoke away. There's no argument that we'll need to, yes.
Yep. Food production, we have 9 to 11 billion people, whatever the final figure is. There's the loss of land to biofuels. There's the rise of prices because of the
to say that we have a structural problem and an organizational problem around the issue of simple food storage. The figure for Africa is 40-50% of the food is being lost, so it's not really, and they have, we now know it's not a good idea to take salmon and put it out of the ground, but they have vast aquifers under the Sahara, which can be used in the whole Sahel region, eventually to make the same mistakes that we made in the West by salinating the land. But so what we have is supply issues, not demand issues. Supply issues are because of
You mean distribution issues?
No, I think we have supply issues. We're using soil. There's radical soil erosion from deforestation and from over-tilling. We can use no-till to do away with the loss of the soil, the water. We have myriad solutions that are around the globe that are very inexpensive, and the rainwater harvesting is obviously the most obvious. We talk about India. India had, until the British arrived there, the tanka, which is where we get the word tank in English, and they had were gathering rainwater until the mid-19th century. When the British gave a modern hydraulic civilization. So we have a supply issue with water, we have a supply issue with the soil. Okay? It's very easy to replenish the soil. We know how to do it. You do it with plant-based, food-based manure, human feces, we do it with biochar, which they're doing already in Australia and South America. We have the solutions so far. So we have the technical solutions on the ecological side that the Gates Foundation does not have. Although there was, I just read about a week ago, a new development in England of a wheat strain which said increased production 25% per hectare, and that's not a GMO. So it's a hybridization process. So that's very promising. But what we've got is a supply problem because we're not storing the food correctly. Simple silos with plastic liners in Africa will save a vast portion of the African grain crop. And then we have supply problem because of biofuels, because of the droughts, which are caused by global warming, because of the rise in prices, because we're allowing.
To mention those 10 seconds.
We don't necessarily have a production problem, and we have a supply problem.
Well, I hope you're right, but I don't think you are, for a whole series of reasons. The first is I'm very skeptical of this golden time before the British arrived. One of the great, it seems to me, problems with the agro-ecological movement, which otherwise I have enormous respect for and hope for, is this idea that there was, this sort of Edenic thing that we had, there are real differences now. First of all, it's the world that perhaps had saner solutions, and there's a question about that, about whether they were really saner. If they were so sane, why was there a famine every 30 years for the last 5,000 years if they worked so well? I mean, even talking a little condescendingly about modern hydraulic civilization, but the fact is people in India live better, longer, and in better health, et cetera, and don't have famines in this modern hydraulic civilization. Back in the days of the Tanka, they had a famine every 30 years. So I'm skeptical of that, first. Second, even if I believed it, which I don't, we moved from a rural to an urban civilization. All bets are off. In that sense, at least, this is a different world. We now live in a world in which either it is already the case, or it soon will be the case, that the majority of people in the world live in cities. They are not going to be able to do any of these things, whether in the industrial agriculture model or the other model. Second point. And we're going to have to figure out. Second, what you call a supply problem, I consider not to be as easily resolvable as you present it. It is true that there are parts of the world, and it will even be accentuated by global warming, if the models are right, or even partly right, that will actually produce more food. Unfortunately, they'll be the rich countries, It's another bad deal for the poor of the world. It is true that, you know, Europe may very well produce more food, not less, or rather faster, with the change in the climate, particularly in the northern Europe. Parts of, you know, northern Scandinavia, for example, that weren't, didn't produce much food, will probably in 40, 50 years produce food, et cetera, et cetera. I don't, you know, for me, talking about, you know, we could get all this down to some other place, you know, implies a whole series of changes, so radical, far more radical than I think the food rights movement is calling for. I mean, you have to have a world government, for one thing. I mean, you mentioned rationality before. You literally have to, you know, you'd have to move foodstuffs around the way you would in a properly run nation state. I think that's so far away that either we'll solve the problem before, you know, even the most optimistic people, the sort of UN purists, people who really believe, you know, the UN is the first step towards some new global order, world government, whatever you have, you know, don't think it's going to come in the next 100 years. And I don't think that's the sort of thing that people who are interested in activism should pursue, because it's such a long-range thing. And the problem of food is much, much more immediate. So I don't see how the fact that there are surpluses in other parts of the world is really going to help us very much, not also because of national interests. The other thing, you know, I would say about what you say is you don't talk about the effect of politics, and by which I mean, I think, for example, that we're in for quite a long period of war in the global south. I think the period that Steven Pinker talks about with the decline of war is actually starting to come to an end. I think you're seeing a situation in the Arab world, which turns out the Arab Spring is as much about ethnic cleansing, or rather confessional cleansing, the war between Shia and Sunni, as it is about democracy and getting rid of these old secular tyrants. You know, whoever thought you'd see, you know, open battle, I mean, proper combat, in between Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. But that's, and yet that's what happened, that's what's happening in this town by the Lebanese border. At the Al-Nusra Front is a sort of Al-Qaeda spin-off. And Hezbollah has committed itself to the Assad regime. Well, in these situations, these sorts of distributive ideas, I just think they imply a kind of stability and comedy that we don't have. I think I should take someone else. I'm happy to talk to you after, but I suspect.
Yeah, you can talk about food in a kind of generic way, but obviously not all food is created equal. And it seems like it's one thing to talk about 89 billion people and like a bowl of rice and vegetables, but it's another thing to talk about being a billion of those people with hamburgers and steaks. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the demand side and changes in diet that go along with economic development and how that might be addressed in mainstream and activism.
Well, I mean, it is true that beef farming is a very inefficient way of getting people calories and protein. It also has, of course, environmental damage, you know, for the obvious reasons, both in terms of water supply, and even, you know, as the former Secretary of State James Baker put it, cow farts. I mean, it's actually not a trivial matter, this methane. It's funny, but you know, once you get into ag land, you have a rather different view of the world. It's not a subject matter I ever thought I would know anything about. To put it that way, I did not exactly grow up on a farm. I don't think so. If we're talking about efficient ways of getting people protein and calories, meat is a very inefficient way. And beef is probably the most inefficient meat. Pork and poultry are more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you actually look at the figures, you don't find that the rich, the great increases in wealth in coastal China and parts of India have radically increased these questions. It's true that meat has a particular role in Chinese culture. It's a political reassurance. There are whole books written about this. There's a very good book called Literally Food in Chinese Culture. And when things go wrong in China, one of the ways the government almost invariably responds is to send lower-priced meat into the city markets as a way of sort of reassuring people. And it's a kind of cultural signal, everybody understands, that things are really okay. That if they can do that, it means, you know, things aren't so bad. But I don't, you know, again, I certainly think in the long term we're going to have to think this through. But how I think you're better off talking about increases in production in the shorter term. Whether it's that we know how to do it already or we have to develop the ways, I mean, leave that question out of it. But I think as a practical matter, you know, getting people off of meat when all these people in China, you know, it's very difficult. If you go to Vietnam or you go to China, I've been spending a bit of time in China, and you say that, the thing you just said, you know, people just sort of basically look at you and say, well, you know, it's our turn. Fuck off. And from a certain perspective, they're absolutely right. You know, it's like when the whale controversies, the Japanese always say, you know, you ate whale for, you know, half of your coastal towns, you know, or got rich on the business of whaling. You could say in slavery too, but that would involve us talking about Brown University in this crowd. One has to be very careful. I remember being in Japan, people, you know, they love to take, you know, Americans or Western Europeans to the whale sushi. It gave them enormous satisfaction. And, you know, in a certain way, one understands it. But you're certainly not going to convince some newly middle-class person in Chengdu that he or she shouldn't have pork. I mean, that's not going to happen. So I think we're back on the production and distribution, there I do agree with you, side, rather than some kind of massive change in habit.
Sam, and then maybe one more question, or two short questions?
Yeah, just briefly. Sort of building on Bill's question, just curious whether people like Michael Pollan or Alice Flutters, or just, it's been issues in American industrial agriculture that are relatively well described, and a lot of the room read a lot of articles, whether that adds anything to the discussion or whether it's just a kind of nuanced point in time. How does some of this improve? It
doesn't fit in at all. I mean, my favorite Alice Flutters story was something, I used to know Alice Flutters slightly, but, and she's a friend of friends, but I saw that profile of her that 60 Minutes did, and she takes, I think it was Diane Sawyer, into her kitchen, a sort of gorgeous kitchen in the Berkeley Hills, and she makes some fantastic thing for breakfast, some wonderful frittata of some sort. And it is fantastic, and if you've ever been, had the good fortune to be in her restaurant or the hundreds of spin-off restaurants that have improved the way, you know, people in this room eat, you should be grateful to Alice Waters. And Michael Pollan is kind of, you know, he's the kind of, I don't know, St. Ignatius figure in all this or something. It has nothing to do with the lives of lower middle class or poor people in this country, let alone anywhere else. I think it's a total irrelevance. First of all, you know, Alice Waters has one child. She doesn't have four whom she gets to, you know, has to deal with, and she doesn't have the stress of an unsatisfactory job and an insufficient paycheck and all the things that make family life for people who aren't very prosperous usually quite difficult. I mean, you know, it just seems to me it has nothing to do with anything. I don't think it has that much to do with anything in the United States, right?
Do you think you have an ethical obligation to the smaller farmers that were forced to urbanize?
Well, I think farming is a culture, and I think that the kind of small farming we're talking about in this country can, at least when it produces certain things, be made to work economically. I mean, again, to use the Alice Waters example, the farmers in Napa who supply her stores, her restaurants and those sorts of restaurants make a perfectly good living. Whether you can preserve African smallholder agriculture of farms of less than a hectare and a half is to me a very open question, whether we have an obligation or not to do it. I don't know that it's feasible. It seems to me, I don't mean necessarily, I'm certainly not suggesting that one should go back to the structural adjustment and the Washington Consensus idea and make it all big export farms. But I'm not sure you're not gonna have to have much larger amounts of land, whether you want to or not, for small farmers in the global south. I don't see how, particularly since, remember, each generation splits the land up. So you're actually talking, in 2013, you're not even talking about the smallholder farmer of 1983. You're talking about a smallholder farmer who's probably died, left his farm to his six children, or to the boys, anyway, even though the women do all the work. That they're half, a third, et cetera, the size. So I don't know whether that is still possible. I don't know. Were you talking about here or there? Maybe I haven't answered you.
One more about abroad.
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think it's very difficult to do it, to keep it in the places where the smallholder question is central. I think we're going to have to figure out, some way that's not the current system, but also not, obviously these mega farms that don't feed anybody or don't give people a proper living. It's a good question. I think the answer is it has some role in migration and in both internal migration and external migration. But I think the principal reason people migrate, whether it's from Africa to Europe or from or from an African countryside to an African city, is because there's work. I mean, the fact of the matter, no matter how bad things are in the cities, they're better than in the countryside. You meet people in Tanzania, Kenya, and East Africa who will tell you how terrible their lives are in the cities. And you say, well, would you consider going back to wherever your village is or your land is? And they say, absolutely not. So barring some radical change, the urbanization is no longer stoppable. It's just not. I mean, we're going to live in an increasingly urbanized world. Living in the country will be, you can't sustain it. You certainly can't sustain it with 9 billion people. It's not going to happen. There'll be movements back to the land. I mean, if taking, countervailing trends, but I think the places where those trends are most evident are in the rich world, where people can sort of afford to do it.
Okay. I think we could end there unless anyone has an extremely pressing question. Okay. Well, thanks so much, David, and thank you.
You're welcome. Else. Thank you.
When is that book coming out?
Oh, sometime in the next July.
Okay. So look for it in bookstores next century.